Welcome back, everyone, to Cyber Mornings Daily. Great to have you with us again. Today, we're doing another deep dive, sort of plunging headfirst into the fascinating and, let's be honest, sometimes slightly unnerving world of cybersecurity. Think of this as your way to stay really well informed without getting lost in all the technical weeds. Our mission today is to, you know, peel back the layers on a few really compelling stories from the digital landscape. We're going to try and untangle these, looking at the challenges, sure, but also the pretty clever solutions popping up. So we've got quite a lineup. First, we'll walk through a real-world cyber attack, hit a major automaker, brought them to a standstill. It's a powerful example of, you know, digital threats becoming very physical. Then we'll shift gears, look at a big proactive step a tech giant is taking to beef up our collective defenses. And finally, we'll unpack this really complex supply chain breach. It just highlights how interconnected everything is now sometimes. Well, sometimes not for the better. It covers a lot of ground.
It really does. And that's what makes it so important, I think. These aren't just, you know, separate news headlines you skim past. When you actually connect the dots, these things that seem unrelated, they paint a really cohesive picture of the modern cyber world. It's this constant dance, isn't it? Offense and defense, back and forth.
Exactly. That's the heart of it. We're going to explore not just what happened, but try to get into the why and the how, give you that deeper understanding. But without, you know, get totally bogged down in jargon, it's not just about relaying news. It's about the context, the mechanics, and what it all means for you, whether you're in tech, leading a business, or just using digital stuff every day. Yeah, let's get into these digital dominoes and defensive maneuvers. All right, let's kick things off with this first story. It really brings the digital threat into the real, tangible world. I want you to picture this. One of the world's biggest car manufacturers, a name everyone knows, luxury engineering, you know, ruggedness, suddenly, bam, they can't build cars, they can't sell cars. We're talking huge assembly lines, multiple continents, just silent. Dealerships can't process sales. Parts departments grind to a halt. This isn't some Hollywood disaster movie plot. This actually happened recently to Jaguar Land Rover, JLR. They got hit by a pretty significant cyber incident, and it forced them to take some really drastic steps. They proactively shut down key systems across their global operations just to contain it.
Yeah, and this wasn't just like a minor IT glitch. Mm. This was a strategic decision, basically hitting the big red emergency stop button on a massive multi-billion dollar company.
And the scale of JLR, it's worth underlining that, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
To get the impact, you have to understand just how big they are. Mm. This isn't some small niche car maker. We're talking a global giant.
Yeah.
Their revenue last year, over $38 billion.
Oh.
Yeah. They make over 400,000 vehicles a year. That's nearly 500,000 luxury SUVs, performance cars, Range Rovers, Defenders, Jaguars coming off lines to the UK, Slovakia, India, Brazil. They employ 39,000 people globally, design, manufacturing, sales, support, everything. So when an organization this big with these complex integrated supply chains gets hit, the ripple effect isn't just big, it's seismic. Impacts thousands of jobs, millions of customers.
And the fallout was immediate, really tangible. Like in the UK, dealerships suddenly couldn't register new cars. Imagine showing up to get your brand new Range Rover all excited and they're like, sorry, systems are down, can't finalize the sale. Can't legally register it.
Nightmare scenario for customer trust.
Yeah.
And just lost revenue right there.
Exactly. And beyond sales, getting parts for service and maintenance, that got hit hard too. Leaving owners stuck, needing repairs or just routine servicing, it really shows how a digital attack has these very real physical consequences. It goes way beyond just the initial system hack.
It really does. Because when you shut down those core systems proactively, it just cascades. Everything stops. It's not just the IT network going dark. It directly hits the cyber-physical systems running the factories, the assembly lines. They rely on constant data flow robotics, inventory, quality control. They just stop.
Dead halt.
And the supply chains, those super efficient, just-in-time ones, they seize up. Affects hundreds of suppliers globally.
Yeah.
And obviously processing orders, delivering cars, after-sale service, all crippled. It highlights something critical. For modern manufacturing, a cyber problem isn't just an IT issue anymore. It quickly becomes operational paralysis. Hits the bottom line, reputation, even the economy. It forces a rethink about, you know, OT security versus IT security and how they converge.
Right. Now, JLR did put out a statement. They confirmed they acted fast, shut systems down to mitigate things. And importantly, they said at that time there was no evidence any customer data has been stolen, which is, you know, some relief.
Small comfort, yeah.
But they were clear about the severity. Said retail and production were severely disrupted, and they committed to restarting things carefully, methodically, which tells you something about the scale of the recovery needed.
And the timing is interesting too, isn't it? Reportedly happened over a weekend.
Yeah, I saw that. Classic move.
Absolutely classic. It's a well-known tactic. Threat actors know companies often have fewer staff on weekends.
Mm-hmm.
Security teams might have slower response times. That gives the attackers a bigger window, you know, more time to dig in, look around, steal data, or launch their main attack ransomware, maybe a wiper before anyone notices. It maximizes their impact and the disruption time. Just exploiting a basic operational vulnerability, really.
Mm. But despite how big this was, JLR hasn't shared a lot of specifics, have they? No timeline for getting back to normal, no detail on what kind of attack it was. We don't know if it's ransomware or a wiper or something else entirely. Leaves a lot of questions.
Yeah, and that lack of detail isn't actually that unusual right after a big sophisticated attack.
Yeah.
But it can be telling. It takes time, sometimes weeks, even months, for forensic teams to really dig in, figure out the full scope, the root cause, the whole attack chain. Public statements are usually super cautious. You don't want to give the attackers tactical info, right? Or cause more panic or legal issues down the line.
Makes sense.
Plus, at the time the news broke, no big ransomware gangs were publicly claiming it, which often happens fast with these high-profile targets.
Ah, okay. So the silence itself might mean something.
Could mean it's complex, or maybe not typical ransomware. Hard to say for sure without more info, but it highlights the difficulty in figuring things out quickly.
So what's the takeaway here for, you know, for everyone listening? I think it's about thinking about how fragile our connected world is, how many services you rely on every day, ordering food, banking, healthcare, utilities, depend on this complex digital infrastructure. What happens when just one critical link breaks, like it did for JLR? This incident is just a stark reminder. Digital threats become physical disruptions, fast. Hits supply chains, stops factories, messes up consumer experiences. It's like digital dominoes falling, affecting us all. Makes you wonder if we're building enough resilience into these systems. Okay, so that JLR story really puts the focus on the reactive side, right? The crisis management after the attack hits. But what about preventing these things in the first place? What can be done, like industry-wide, to build stronger defenses before the storm? Well, we've got some pretty big news on that front from a major tech player, Microsoft. They're taking a really significant step, a bold move, actually, to boost security for their Azure cloud client.
Yeah, this is a big one.
The headline is this. Starting October 1st, 2025, Microsoft is going to start enforcing multi-factor authentication MFA for all Azure resource management actions. And this isn't just like a friendly suggestion, it's becoming mandatory. It's going to impact tons of organizations, individuals globally, IT departments, developers. It fundamentally changes how they interact with their cloud stuff.
Right. And for a lot of our listeners who are deep in cybersecurity, MFA is probably, you know, security 101,
yep.
A baseline.
Mm.
But just to clarify, we're not just talking about a password. MFA means you need a second, maybe even a third step to prove it's really you.
Like the code from your phone app.
Exactly. Or a physical key, like a YubiKey, maybe a fingerprint, facial recognition. It's about using multiple different types of credentials.
Mm-hmm.
So your password is the first layer, the key to the door. MFA is like needing a second key or a code or your fingerprint to get past in the next lock. It just makes it way harder for attackers. Even if they steal your password, they're stuck without that second factor. It's not just good practice. It's a critical control. Changes the whole risk game for account compromise.
And the why behind Microsoft pushing this so hard is pretty clear, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's a core part of their bigger Secure Future initiative, the SFI. The goal is simple, but really powerful. Protect Azure clients from unauthorized access. By making MFA mandatory for these administrative actions, they're basically lifting the security bar for everyone in the Azure ecosystem. Makes the whole platform more resilient against credential theft and other attacks.
And where exactly does this enforcement apply? It's quite broad, right?
It is pretty comprehensive. It covers accounts signing into the Azure command line interface, the CLI, which lots of people use for scripting and automation. Also Azure PowerShell, another key tool for admin tasks. The Azure mobile app, too, so security is consistent across devices. And importantly, it includes infrastructure as code tools, IAC, which are huge now for automated deployments. Even direct REST API endpoints.
Okay, and it specifically targets certain actions.
Yes, specifically create, update, or delete operations. Basically any action that changes Azure resources.
The important stuff.
Exactly. The high privilege actions attackers love to target to cause damage or gain persistence.
So if you're an admin, DevOps, developer managing Azure, this directly hits your workflow. And Microsoft's giving a heads up, right? Telling people to upgrade their tools.
Yeah, they're advising users to update Azure CLI, to 2.76 or later, and Azure PowerShell, to 14.3 or later, just to make sure everything works smoothly when the enforcement kicks in. Avoid nasty surprises. It's a call to get ready.
Makes sense.
And a really critical point here. This enforcement isn't just for human logins. It specifically applies to automation and scripts that use user identities.
Ah, okay. So not just people logging in manually.
Right. Think about all the automated processes, CI/CD, pipelines, deployment scripts, security scanners. They often run with service accounts or identities linked back to users. Securing these automated routes with MFA is just as vital, maybe even more so. A compromised script can do way more damage way faster than one compromised person. Close is a big potential attack vector that sometimes gets missed.
Okay, so it's a big change. How are they rolling it out? Just flipping a switch on October 1st?
No, and that's smart. Microsoft gets that. You can't just do that with something this big, impacting potentially millions. They're doing a gradual rollout, applying it progressively across tenants worldwide.
So giving organizations time to adapt.
Exactly. Time to adapt, make changes without causing immediate chaos.
And there's some flexibility too, right? For companies that need more time.
Yeah, that's really pragmatic. Global administrators can actually request a postponement of the enforcement date if they really need it until July 2026. It shows they're balancing the security push with, you know, operational reality. Some big companies have complex legacy stuff, intricate workflows. They need more transition time.
Security with empathy, almost.
Sort of, yeah. And they're providing tools, too. Admins can track their MFA registration progress using reports or specific PowerShell scripts. Makes it manageable. That support is key for getting everyone on board.
Okay, so we get the what, the how, the scope, but let's hammer home the why. Why is MFA such a big deal? How effective is it, really?
The numbers are just, well, they're staggering. Microsoft's own studies, based on tons of data, show that 99.99% of MFA-enabled accounts resist hacking attempts.
99.99%.
Wow, almost perfect, right? Think about that. Nearly every attempt to hack an MFA-protected account just fails. It's not a smart improvement. It's a near-total defense against credential theft, one of the most common attacks. And even if attackers do manage to get the password somehow, MFA still cuts the risk of account compromise by 98.56%. It just makes stolen passwords almost useless without that second factor. It's foundational.
And this fits into a bigger picture at Microsoft, doesn't it? It's not just Azure.
Exactly. This isn't happening in isolation. Remember, Microsoft owns GitHub. GitHub started enforcing two-factor authentication for all active developers back in January 2024.
Right.
So it's a consistent strategy. They've been pushing MFA for intra-ID global admins, rolling out conditional access policies requiring it for admin portals, for users accessing cloud apps, for high-risk sign-ins. It's a sustained, multi-pronged effort across their whole ecosystem, systematically raising the security baseline for everyone using their cloud stuff.
So it really makes you think, doesn't it? If this relatively simple second step, a code, a fingerprint, whatever, stops nearly all account hacks, why isn't everyone already doing it? This Microsoft move feels like more than just a policy change. It's like reshaping the industry standard.
It really is.
It pushes the whole cloud world, huge corporations, individual devs, towards a much safer baseline, turns best practice into a requirement, ultimately makes everyone in Azure that little bit safer. It's a big proactive defensive play. Sets precedent. Okay, so we've covered the reactive crisis with JLR and the proactive defense with Microsoft's MFA mandate. But here's the tricky part. Even if you have strong security, like MFA, on your own accounts, what happens when a third party you trust, something deeply integrated into your work, becomes the weak link?
Ah, the supply chain problem.
Yeah. Exactly. Which brings us to this next story. It's fascinating, maybe a bit alarming. A breach at an AI chatbot maker called SalesLoft and the fallout. Well, it spread far and wide across corporate America and beyond.
Mm.
So the core problem started at SalesLoft itself. Their AI chatbot, the Drift application, tons of companies use it, right? For customer interaction, lead gen, turning chats into sales. It's central to a lot of businesses.
Very popular tool, yeah.
SalesLoft found a security issue in their systems, and the big consequence was a mass theft of authentication tokens from their platform.
Right, and mass theft of authentication tokens sounds technical, but let's break down why that's so serious. Think of these tokens as like digital keys or maybe digital passports. When you log into a service or when apps talk to each other, these tokens get generated. They prove who you are and what you're allowed to do temporarily without needing your password every time. Makes things smooth.
Okay, convenient but risky if stolen.
Hugely risky. Because if an attacker steals that token, they don't need your password anymore. They effectively log in as you. They get all your permissions, all your access rights within whatever services that token is good for. Like someone stealing your car keys, they can drive your car, open your linked garage door, access the car's connected home features, all because they have the key.
Got it. And the ripple effect here was bigger than expected.
Way bigger. This is where Google's threat intelligence group, GTIG, comes in. They made a critical and pretty worrying discovery. The breach wasn't just about getting access to Salesforce data, which was the first big worry for SalesLoft customers. GTIG found the attackers also stole valid authentication tokens for hundreds of other online services that customers had integrated with SalesLoft Drift.
Hundreds. Wow. So it wasn't just one vendor breach.
No, it was like a potential skeleton key into a whole ecosystem of client environments, a gateway.
And the scope of that was huge.
Immense. These stolen tokens didn't just open SalesLoft or Salesforce. They potentially unlock doors to all sorts of critical business platforms, things like Slack, you know, for internal chat, Google Workspace for emails and docs, Amazon S3 for storage, Microsoft Azure for cloud infrastructure, even OpenAI, the AI platform.
So a single breach point potentially compromising all these other major services?
Exactly. It's a web of interconnected vulnerabilities. Google even admitted one of their corporate Salesforce instances got hit, and a very small number of Google Workspace accounts were accessed via their SalesLoft integration. Shows even highly secure companies weren't immune.
And what were the attackers actually doing with this access? The group GTIG called UNC6395.
They weren't just sitting on the access. They were actively siphoning large amounts of data from lots of corporate Salesforce instances. Then, GTIG saw them digging through all that stolen data, like panning for gold, specifically hunting for high-value credentials, things they could use to dig even deeper.
What kind of credentials were they after?
Really valuable stuff. AWS keys, those give programmatic access to Amazon Web Services. Yeah. VPN credentials, keys to the internal corporate kingdom, basically. And credentials for other cloud storage, like Snowflake, the data warehouse.
Okay, so not just grabbing data, but looking for keys to unlock even more doors.
Precisely. These credentials would let them pivot from the initial SalesLoft breach right into the victim's deeper systems or even their clients' environments, compromise even more stuff downstream. And it's important to note, this wasn't a flaw in Salesforce itself. The access came entirely through those stolen SalesLoft tokens. The data theft happened between August 8th and 18th, 2025, giving a clear time frame.
Given how serious this was, GTIG's recommendation was pretty blunt, right?
Very blunt. They basically said, if you use SalesLoft Drift for integrations, you should just assume your data is compromised and start remediation immediately.
Wow. No ifs, ands, or buts?
Nope. Assume the worst and act now, regardless of which third-party platform you integrated. And then Salesforce itself took the pretty drastic step of blocking Drift from integrating with its platform and also Slack and Pardo.
That's a huge move from Salesforce, blocking a major integration partner like that.
It is. It's rare. Shows just how concerned they were.
So how do attackers actually use these stolen tokens so effectively to move around?
There's a term for this. Yeah, Joshua Wright at CounterHack calls it authorization sprawl. It describes how these social engineering groups abuse legitimate existing user access tokens. They use them to move smoothly between on-premise systems and cloud systems, kind of bypassing traditional defenses.
So they don't need fancy malware or exploits?
Not necessarily. They exploit the access that's already granted to a legitimate user. From the system's point of view, the activity looks totally normal because it's using valid tokens, even if the person behind it is malicious. This makes these attacks super hard to detect with normal security tools. They just blend in with authorized behavior, creates a mass blind spot.
And the SalesLoft thing didn't just happen out of the blue, right? It follows other similar campaigns.
Correct. It came after a wider social engineering campaign using voice phishing, tricking people into connecting malicious apps to their company's Salesforce portals. That earlier campaign hit big names like Adidas, Alliance Life, Qantas, led to data breaches, extortion, shows this is a persistent threat, often targeting the human element.
And that earlier campaign was linked to a specific group.
Threat intel firms tracked those attackers as UNC 6040. And that group consistently claimed they were the notorious group Shiny Hunters.
Ah, Shiny Hunters. I've heard that name. What's their deal?
They've been around since at least 2020. Known for being really good at social engineering, breaking into cloud platforms, hitting third-party IT providers, and they love the limelight. They often post the stolen databases they grab onto underground forums like breach forums used to be, get some attention, maybe helps them sell the data. They're linked to dozens of leaks, hundreds of millions of breach records, but their actual membership, probably very fluid, pulling people from different cybercrime communities on Telegram, Discord, makes them hard to pin down.
So attributing attacks like the sales left one is tricky.
Incredibly tricky. The cybercrime world is murky. Groups claim credit without proof, maybe just for reputation or to confuse investigators. And there's often overlap in tactics with other groups, like Scattered Spider or LFPCS says. You even saw a Telegram channel pop up called Scattered La PS Hunters 4.0 trying to claim the sales loft hack just for notoriety.
So did Shiny Hunters actually do the sales loft hack?
Google's threat intel team says there's no compelling evidence right now to definitively link sales loft to Shiny Hunters or any other known group. Their understanding seems based mostly on public reports and the attack patterns, not solid links. It just shows how hard attribution really is.
Okay, so it's complex, still unfolding, and Sales Loft brought in the big guns to investigate.
Yeah, they hired Mandiant, which is Google Cloud's incident response division.
Yeah.
Top-tier experts. That tells you how seriously they're taking it and probably how complex the investigation is. It's not a quick fix. It's a deep forensic job.
So wrapping this one up, what's the big lesson here for everyone listening? Whether you run a business, write code, or just use lots of online services.
I think it just powerfully underlines the inherent risks in our connected digital world. Every service you integrate, every app you approve, every vendor you give access to becomes a potential entry point.
It's not just about locking your own front door anymore.
Exactly. It's not just your passwords, your MFA. You have to think about and trust the security of every single vendor you connect to, your digital life, your digital home, that digital supply chain. It's only as strong as its weakest link.
Yeah.
The trust we place in partners is now a critical attack surface itself.
Wow. Okay, that was quite a journey today through the cyber landscape. We started with that raw, real-world pain of the JLR attack cyber threats causing actual physical paralysis in manufacturing. Then we shifted to the proactive side, that huge push from Microsoft enforcing MFA across Azure, a major move towards a stronger baseline defense for everyone.
A really significant step, yeah.
And finally, we dove into that intricate, frankly scary, sales loft supply chain breach, showing how stolen tokens from one place could cascade, potentially compromising hundreds of other services, that web of trust being exploited.
And taken together, these stories really do paint that essential picture, don't they? They highlight that crucial, often delicate balance between innovation and connectivity on one side and robust, adaptable security on the other. Attackers are constantly evolving. They're not just hitting tech vulnerabilities. They're exploiting the trust, the legitimate access we grant our digital partners. It's not a problem with a single fix. It's this ongoing dynamic challenge for everyone.
It really is. Which leaves us with a final thought, something for you, our listeners, to chew on. As our lives, our businesses, our critical infrastructure get more and more tangled up with digital services, with cloud platforms, what responsibility do we as users, consumers, leaders actually have to push for and adopt stronger security like MFA? And just as important, what role do organizations play in really rigorously vetting and constantly monitoring the security of every single vendor, every link in their digital supply chain?
It's not just an IT department problem anymore, is it?
Not at all. It's a shared challenge, needs collective vigilance, continuous learning, and a real commitment to adapting from all of us. It truly affects us all, and how we respond shapes our digital future. Okay, that's our deep dive for today on Cyber Mornings Daily, looking at these digital dominoes and defensive maneuvers. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll catch you next time as we continue exploring the cutting edge of this digital world.